Welcome to Madang Podcast. Today's special guest is Robert Ellsberg, who is the editor-in-chief and publisher of Orbis Books. He is the author or editor of 25 books, and today he will share his two edited books on Pilgrimage the 60s and on Pilgrimage the 70s. In this episode, he shares about his father, Daniel Ellsberg, and the Pentagon Papers, his work with Dorothy Day, and Day's involvement with farmers' protests, Cuban Revolution, the Catholic Worker newspaper, her prophetic work, and so much more. Please stay tuned. Please join Homebrew Christianity's online class, Bonhoeffer and the Future of Faith. This class will explore the work of Dietrich Bonhoeffer and examine how his ideas remain relevant to the challenges we face today. It is hosted by Drs. Tripp Fuller and Jeff Pugh. The class is free, but donations help support the continued amazing work of Homebrewed Christianity. Please visit www.tripfuller.com to sign up today. Orbis Books is offering 30% off three books by Robert Ellsberg, who is a publisher at Orbis Books: A Living Gospel, Reading God's Story in Holy Lives, and On Pilgrimage, the 60s, and On Pilgrimage, the 70s. These three great books provide a deeper understanding of Dorothy Day and also the lives of saints, prophets, and spiritual masters. Order these three books today at orbisbooks.com and use discount code MAD, M-A-D, to get 30% off.
For sponsorship inquiries, please email madangpodcast@gmail.com. This is Madang, an outdoor living room for guests to share their experiences and their work. I invite you to come in and stay for a while.
Welcome to Madang Podcast. Today's special guest is Robert Ellsberg, who is the editor-in-chief and publisher of Orbis Books, where he served for over 35 years. From 1975 to 1980, he was part of the Catholic Worker community in New York City, working with CW founder Dorothy Day for the last 5 years of her life. For 2 years, he served as managing editor of the Catholic Worker newspaper. He studied religion and literature at Harvard College and later earned a THM degree in theology from Harvard Divinity School before joining Orbis in 1987. He has continued to promote the work and legacy of Dorothy Day, editing 5 volumes of her writings, including The Duty of Delight and All the Way to Heaven. Robert has written and edited 25 books, including 6 books on saints and holiness. For over 10 years, he has written a daily entry, Blessed Among Us, Forgive Us This Day by Liturgical Press. Today, I'm so grateful that Robert Ellsberg is here with us to share his 2 books on Pilgrimage, the 60s, and On Pilgrimage, the 70s. May 1st, 2023 represents the 90th anniversary of the Catholic Worker, so it is a great celebration. Mariah Shriver wrote about the books. This collection of Dorothy Day's columns has, from the last years of her life, highlights the qualities that truly make her such a unique human being. She embodies the meaning of faith in action and points us all towards the promise that a better world is possible. So thank you so much, Robert. I know you're so busy traveling and writing and being a publisher, etc. Thank you so much for joining me today on Madang Podcast.
Thank you very much, Grace. I'm really glad to join you.
It is so wonderful because, you know, you edited, I edited Reverend Jackson's book, which is behind me, Keeping Hope Alive, and you are such a wonderful person to work with. I'm so honored that Orbis Books published it. So thank you so much.
Thank you.
Yeah, it was a joy to work with you on that. So before we get into your fabulous 2 volumes here, I wanted to just talk about you know, I'm sure so many people have asked you questions and asked you so many things about what happened with the Pentagon Papers. So if you can just tell us, you know, your father is Daniel Ellsberg, and that, I don't know, it must have been such an intriguing part of your life. So if you can share a little bit about that.
I remember when I first happened to mention that to you. And of course, you didn't grow up in the United States. It's not your history. And so you were really fascinated by the story. And then Reverend Jackson walked in and you said, Reverend Jackson, do you know do you know who Daniel Ellsberg is? And he said, of course. And he said, this is his son. And he like did this double take. Like, it was,
I remember that so clearly.
But so maybe there are other listeners who don't know who he is. So I'll share that with them. Yeah. So my father was a Defense Department and State Department analyst. He worked on planning around nuclear war. His interest was in trying to prevent nuclear war. This is back in the 1950s and early 60s. And then in the mid 60s, he was working in the Pentagon and went to Vietnam for 2 years. And while he was there, he became very disillusioned, to say the least, with the war in Vietnam, which he thought was a terrible mistake, and he wanted to know what he could do to try to help end that. But when he came back, one of the things he did was he was assigned to work on a top secret history of the Vietnam War that came to be known as the Pentagon Papers. And reading that really opened his eyes to the history of the war and made him feel that it was not a mistake, it was a crime that was had been started all together on ignoble premises, and meanwhile massive amounts of violence was occurring there, and he was inspired by two things to action. One was contacts that he had in the government who told him that, contrary to most people's belief, President Nixon was planning to expand the war. And this is 1969. Secondly, he encountered young men who were going to prison to protest the draft or refuse to cooperate with the draft. And that raised the question for him about what he could do to end the war if he was willing to go to jail himself. Wow. And that's when he got the concept of copying this top secret 7,000-page history of the Vietnam War and making it available to Congress, which he thought might inspire congressional hearings. Well, that never happened. He copied the papers, but 2 years later, when he couldn't get Congress interested in it, he turned to the press, and the New York Times published the Pentagon Papers, or at least began to. They were enjoined by the government, which tried to stop them, and it went all the way to the Supreme Court. In the meantime, he was underground distributing copies of the paper to other papers, including the Washington Post and many other papers. So the Supreme Court finally upheld the right of the press to publish the papers, and he was indicted and charged with 11 felony counts, facing 115 years in prison. So this was a lot of, you know, what was going on in my background, in my life as I was growing up. He ultimately didn't end up going to prison because 50 years ago, actually in May, the charges were dismissed because of all the revelations of government misconduct that were conducted by the White House, the plumbers, in order to try to silence my father. And that tied in with Watergate, because exactly the same people who were going after him were also the people arrested in the Watergate hotel.
Wow.
So all of that, in fact, Nixon's involvement in Watergate, which would it consisted of obstruction of justice and trying to make payoffs to the Watergate defendants, was to keep them from talking about what they knew about the illegal activities which he had authorized against my father. So Watergate was very much tied to what he had done, and therefore with ultimately his resignation in the face of pending impeachment, and that led to the end of the Vietnam War. So tremendous influence and consequence that came out of this action, in a very indirect way that he never could have imagined. So after the Vietnam War, he returned to his preoccupation with trying to prevent nuclear war, and he's worked on that for decades now. Mm. He's written two memoirs. His most recent one was called The Doomsday Machine, Confessions of a Nuclear War Planner. He's been arrested 100 times. He's done virtually everything he can think of. to try to raise awareness. And as you may know, as listeners may know, he recently disclosed that he has pancreatic cancer.
Yes.
And he has so, you know, issued his kind of final message, which has to do with hoping that a new generation will continue to take up that struggle for peace.
Well, thank you so much for sharing that with us, because, you know, I saw him recently on CNN discussing it. He's 91 years old, a whole lifetime of service, you know, for peace. That's incredible. And how, you know, you were very young. Were you 13 years old when you're helping your dad photocopy the?
Yes.
Papers?
Yeah.
And then your sister was 10 years old.
She was, yes.
Yeah, that's incredible that you at that young age were a part of this history and, you know, really impacted us. So thank you so much to you, your family, your dad. It's incredible. And, you know, we're keeping your dad in our prayers. So, you know, I'm just so grateful for your family. So thank you so much.
Well, and that, his example tied in very much with the kind of subsequent course of my life in talking to me about, you know, undertaking what he considered a kind of act of civil disobedience. He said that he wanted, you know, that to be kind of a legacy. He thought he'd be going to prison for the rest of his life and to show my sister and me that there were the responsibilities of a citizen and a human being. And it raised questions for me about, you know, what my life was going to be about and for, not following necessarily in his footsteps. Mm-hmm. But that's what led me ultimately when I was 19 to go join the Catholic Worker.
Wow.
Because I'd been raised by my mother, who was an Episcopalian in a Christian home. That was not something that I got from my father. But this kind of question of how to combine my faith with the world and its needs, with the cause of peace and justice, led me directly there in 1975.
Well, that's incredible. As you mentioned, he would have gone to prison for life. And when I was listening to his CNN interview, he said that was nothing compared to the atrocity that was happening. When I heard that, I thought that is incredible, because I don't think I would have risked myself. Mm-hmm. You know, my life is too precious. So that's how I would view this.
My father had been in the Marines. Mm-hmm. He'd been in Vietnam in situations of combat with other Marines. He wasn't in the Marines then, but he would go out on patrols to kind of learn about what was happening in the field. And he said, you know, we take for granted that people exhibit physical courage, defending the country or going where they're ordered to go. And any of those times he could have died or he could have lost his legs or been wounded in some terrible way. Mm-hmm. But we're much less accustomed to thinking of civil courage, mm-hmm. people taking great risks for causes of, you know, world peace or you know, saving lives, to risk their job, to risk their security, to risk their security clearances and their opportunity to work in the government in the future. And that, I think, is one of the things that set him apart. And, you know, that it's something we're not accustomed to recognizing or understanding.
Thank you so much for sharing that. You know, he's leaving a great legacy, and, you know, you and your work. And, you know, now as we turn to this book, I think what your father did really impacted, as you said, how you have kind of chosen your way and going to work with Dorothy Day. Mm-hmm. These two volumes are incredible, because for myself as a Protestant, I never really heard of Dorothy Day. And then when I was doing my PhD, I had a Catholic nun, you know, many Catholic nuns were teaching at Toronto School of Theology, Dr. Sister Ellen Leonard. And she was just talking about Dorothy Day one day. And I thought, oh, this is very interesting, because I've never heard of her until in my 20s when I was doing my PhD in my theology. So coming to, you know, read these volumes and understanding your involvement with Dorothy Day, you know, the 60s. So one of them is the 60s, which covers the 1960s and then the 1970s. You really bring a collection of columns and articles written by Dorothy Day. So can you share how you decided to put these volumes together? And as I said in my introduction, you did a lot of other books too, but how did you decide to do these two volumes?
Maybe I should back up a little bit and give a little bit of a portrait of who she was.
That'll be great.
Surely other people who haven't heard
of her. And many of the listeners are Protestant listeners, so they may not be so familiar with Dorothy Day.
Dorothy Day was a convert to Catholicism who was born in 1897 and spent her early life involved in movements for social change, radical reform, protest. Labor unions, anti-war groups. A lot of her friends were socialists, later communists, anarchists. That was her life, was kind of working for social justice and for the poor. She was also a writer, a journalist. She was arrested a couple of times, once for protesting with suffragists, women protesting in Washington for the right to vote. She fell in love with this man, found herself pregnant, and it's a long story, but through this experience, she determined that she wanted to become a Catholic. She wanted her daughter to become a Catholic. And her partner didn't want to get married, didn't believe in marriage, so they separated. And she went through several years of trying to figure out how to put together her new faith and her commitment to the poor and oppressed. And she actually offered a prayer in the Basilica of the Immaculate Conception, Washington, that she would find some sign of her vocation. And when she came home, she found this Frenchman waiting for her, Peter Morin, who'd heard about her and had been looking for someone to put his ideas into action. And that began with the idea of a newspaper that would promote the radical social teachings or the radical message of the gospel. And he said they should start a house of hospitality to begin practicing the works of mercy, feeding the hungry, clothing the naked. Now, this is 1932, 1933, so it was right in the heart of the Depression. It just really struck a bell for her because she came from a newspaper family. She thought, aha, this is what I'm meant to do. And so she starts a newspaper called The Catholic Worker 90 years ago. It'll be on May 1st, 1933, in New York City. Distributing this newspaper that was largely things that she had written or articles by Peter Morin. And it kind of took off very quickly. And then came the House of Hospitality and other houses like that spread around the country. And then there were new aspects of her vision began to take form. One of them was, you know, it's very much based on this idea of Matthew 25, that what we do for the poor, we do directly to Christ. And that inspired the works of mercy in this kind of charitable work she was doing. But that was combined from the beginning with a strong passion for social justice and a commitment to change the conditions in society that give rise to so much poverty. So it wasn't just a typical kind of charity. It combined charity with justice. And then came into that this idea of hers that if we should, you know, if Christ is in our neighbor, we shouldn't kill our neighbor. And the strong commitment to nonviolence that came, that was very unusual at the time for Catholics and for a long time. She was really alone for decades in her commitment to this peace message of Jesus. And that made her very isolated then during World War II. And then later in the 50s, she and the Catholic Worker were involved very much in protests against nuclear war and planning for war. They'd be arrested every year for refusing to participate in civil defense drills that were compulsory in New York City. She'd go to jail. So she was really on the margins. So now in the 60s and 70s are the two volumes that I have, you know, edited here. Dorothy is very known for her other writings, include her autobiography, The Long Loneliness, that tells the story of her conversion and how the Catholic Worker started, and other books that deal more or less with those themes. Life in the Catholic Worker. But most of what she wrote was from the newspaper that she edited over the years. And she had a column in particular that she called On Pilgrimage, that was not just about all of her travels around the country, but really reflected her kind of way of living a life as a kind of pilgrimage, you know, toward a goal of trying to meet Christ, and that determines everything that the significance of everything that happens along the way. So she would write these long columns. Sometimes they would fill half the pages of the paper, and they would describe her travels around the country, visiting other communities, writing about struggles for social justice. In the 60s, there was a lot about the civil rights movement. She became very involved with the farm workers protests in California, labor struggles. And then during the 60s also, as the peace movement, you know, took hold, she was very much in the forefront of that. So Dorothy Day has now been proposed by the church as a candidate for canonization.
Wow.
And to be an official saint. Wow. But a lot of people, you know, I think in this, in light of that, tend to focus on her kind of piety and as a kind of devout Catholic and what a holy woman she was. And I thought that one of the things that was very helpful about collecting these writings from the 60s and 70s is it shows how vitally engaged she was in the social issues of the time. And that for her, there was no difference between her devotional life and her commitment to the poor and social justice and peace. So there's very radical stuff. In the 60s, for instance, in 1962, she goes to Cuba to visit firsthand the revolution.
Yeah,
and you know, it's kind of shocking that she writes these very admiring pieces about what was being done in the way of social justice and for the poor, and really rebuking Christians, you know, who created a movement for communism by not being in the forefront of defending the poor and social justice. Mm-hmm. So it was very radical stuff. So that's 1962.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then later on, the protests around Vietnam, her refusal to pay federal taxes, she almost went to prison over that, her supporting people who were burning their draft cards, her going down to the South and speaking on behalf of racial justice. And then in the 70s, she starts a house of hospitality for homeless women. You know, she's standing up to the IRS and refusing to pay taxes then as well. So this kind of activism, but also, you know, you see right side by side with her deep kind of faith and very, almost, you know, very traditional kind of piety in terms of daily mass and devotion to the saints and the rosary and reading scripture. So she, you know, it's a time also, I thought, going back to the 60s and 70s, there's so many themes from those years that relate to our situation today. Uh-huh. And so I thought that there was something very timely about, I mean, this is going back 50 years, you know, these columns.
Yeah.
But I thought that they were very, they read as if they could have been written today, many of them.
Oh yeah. I thought, you know, reading them, it was just so enlightening because, you know, she's a trailblazer. As a woman doing this, mm-hmm. I could see a man doing it, but a woman and at that time and age and being a mom, a single mom, basically, mm-hmm. I just can't imagine. Like, I would assume in the Catholic Church, if you were a nun, you would have more kind of power or more say in all this. But as just a lay person, I just found her life is so incredible. And for you to kind of compile it into these huge volumes, you know, this is not thin, they're quite thick volumes. It's just incredible. And it does. And as you say, it really speaks to us in our time. So I, you know, when I was growing up, I never, ever thought I would be a writer. First, we were so poor. I only had one or two books in the house because my parents, you know, if it's not essential, we don't get it. Mm-hmm. So I never really read books. You know, they were from the library. I never, ever imagined. But for you, I think growing up in your household, I don't know, maybe with your dad and then photocopying all that. And then you went to work for her and you became the managing editor. Catholic Word. I know there's pictures, so let me share it because I just find that so incredible. That you, how old were you?
Well, I was 19 when I went there, and I was 20 when I became the managing editor of the paper.
That is incredible at the age of 20 to be a managing editor. So there's, you're about 20 in that page. You're so handsome there. I think you look like your dad. And then I think there's another picture of you. So yeah,
with I like, you I like and Dorothy.
Yeah,
I only learned about those pictures a few years ago, her granddaughter found them and sent them to me. I never knew that there was a picture of me with her.
But... Oh my goodness. You must have been in tears looking at these pictures.
I was very, very moved in the way that she's like looking right into the camera there, you know.
Yeah, and so who would have taken this picture?
Oh, there was an old guy at the Catholic Worker named Stanley Vishnevsky, who always had a camera, was always taking pictures. But he died years ago, so I didn't know about these.
Wow. I just find these pictures incredible. I just saw you in a beard recently, because when I first met you, you didn't have a beard, but I guess you always had a beard when you were younger.
As soon as I could grow a beard, I grew a beard.
You look great with the beard. But these pictures are so amazing, because you were so young. My kids are around that age right now, and I can't imagine them being a managing editor of anything. But what was it like to work as a managing editor and being in her presence? And, you have this activism inside of you from your dad, and, you know, it's within your family. So how was it?
Well, you know, I can't say that I had any qualification for that job. I'd only been at the Catholic Worker for a few months when she asked me to do this. So it's, it's a sign, I think, of how desperate she was.
She probably saw gifts in you.
Well, I think that's also true. I think that says something about her. There was a woman who was the managing editor of the paper before me, and she wanted to go to nursing school and had been, I think, praying for someone to come along with this off her shoulders. Now, at that time, I didn't know that I was going to stay at the Catholic Worker that long. I was planning to take a year off from college, and I was going to be there for a couple months. This really did change my life in deep ways, because I ended up, staying, so much longer, 5 years. I didn't know how do you edit a paper. I didn't know that at all. I just had to learn, on the job. Uh-huh. And on the one hand, I think Dorothy did have this uncanny way of being able to recognize people's gifts and to encourage them, because so often what prevents us is not just that nobody asked us, but that we're afraid to step forward, and we doubt our own capacity. We think, I'm not worthy, or I'm not capable of doing that. So it's never something I would have asked to do or imagined doing. On the other hand, you could say that, at least from my experience, that it was prescient that she was pointing me in the direction of what turned out to be my life's work and vocation. I've been a publisher and editor for over 35 years, and not just an editor, but an editor of her writings, five volumes of her books. So there was that's where it all began for me. And I really kind of took to it, and I enjoyed coming up with ideas for authors who could write for us, which was a little different, because the paper tended to be just sort of whatever had come in by press day would go into the paper. And I, on the other hand, would think of what are the themes or issues that I think we should be getting? Who are some of the authors that should write for us? And I was kind of audacious in asking people like Robert Coles or Henry Nouwen or E.F. Schumacher, or people like that, to write for us. And I would do like thematic issues around nuclear war. Once I did one for the 50th anniversary of the execution of Sacco and Vanzetti, which probably means nothing to you, but a great event in labor radical history in America. Anyway, I did a theme on Latin America. Now, she didn't actually like that sort of thing. She liked it for the paper to be a little bit of everything. Each issue should have things about peace work, about community, hospitality, about life on the land. She said this is all about the same thing. What's the point? And so she didn't always agree with my choices, but she never rebuked me or anything like that. Now, she was in her late 70s at this point, and considered herself more or less retired. And so that volume of the 70s that I edited, I arrived in 1975. So the last 5 years of the book represent the time that I was sort of around there. And you see her by that time really winding down quite a lot. She had a heart attack in 1976. And after that, she really didn't travel anymore. And she became increasingly confined to her room at Mary House, the House of Hospitality for Women, the Lower East Side. So I only did it for 2 years as editor of the paper. I really kind of burned out. I realized that I was way over my head in terms of writing about things and representing something that I didn't feel I totally embodied. An aspect of that was my decision ultimately to become a Catholic, which I was not at this time. 1980, I became Catholic, and that's when I was ready to leave, and I went back to college. And she died very soon after that. So the first thing I did was edit a volume of her selected writings, which is still in print. And that kind of started me on this path.
Wow. Who published that one, the first one?
Alfred A. Knopf, big trade publisher, but it's in print now with Orbis Books.
Oh, that's so good. You know, when I've met you so many times since, you know, we started working on Keeping Hope Alive, and you seem like this mild, kind of laid back person. I don't know how you write all these books and edit them, and you have a day job too. So it's just so, because there's other people who, you know, people that both you and I know who are like,
anyone meeting you would not be surprised that you've written lots of books.
But you are so, you're too kind, but you're so laid back. I'm like, I don't know how you even do all this, because it's incredible. And so, you know, these two volumes, I just found it so interesting, because the introduction was like so heartfelt, because nobody could have done it, I think, except for you. I just feel like, because you were actually with her, this is part of your work. And, you know, you were doing the managing editing of that. And there was one line from the introduction you wrote, you know, Dorothy Day's work was a call for a revolution of the heart. Mm-hmm. And I think that's so, you know, that to me, that really struck me, because, you know, we're thinking of revolutionary workers, you know, changing everything, but this is revolution of the heart. And I think, I don't know, it's so meaningful to me. And, you know, when I read things like this, I just, you know, I'm a PCUSA minister, but I feel like, oh, I want to be a Catholic now. Because you guys do all the interesting things in life. So,
Dorothy Day was not your typical Catholic, you know, but the interesting thing is the ways that, you know, for someone who was kind of an outlier through much of her life, she now kind of stands squarely within the path or the vision that Pope Francis has outlined.
Yeah.
He in turn is sort of the Pope that she would have dreamed up, kind of her dream Pope. But the parallels between their messages is uncanny.
Yeah.
So it wasn't surprising that when Pope came to America in 2015, he spoke at Congress, and he organized his whole talk around four great Americans. One was Abraham Lincoln, Martin Luther King, and then two Catholics, Thomas Merton, the Trappist monk, who was a good friend of hers, contributor to The Worker, and Dorothy Day.
Wow.
And I can only imagine there were a lot of people in Congress scratching their heads and wondering who in the world we were talking about, because she's still not really a household name at all.
This episode, she will be a household name.
There you go.
we need one podcast
at a time.
Yeah, well, the thing is, most of the listeners are Protestant, because, you know, this Madang is hosted by Christian Century magazine. But I, you know, we Protestants don't know enough about the Catholic, you know, writers and Catholic workers and Catholic theologians enough, because in our seminaries, you know, when we're teaching our students, mm-hmm. it's all the Protestant, we can't even get through all of them anyway. Mm-hmm. So I think, you know, through podcasts like this and other platforms, it's so important for those who are non-Catholic to really come to read books like this. You might be my first Catholic guest. I don't know. I can't remember all my guests at this point, but you may be my first one. And I think we might have to have more Catholic guests, but you know, this it's incredible what she did. And you mentioned earlier about, you know, visiting Cuba. So you included her work about, you know, the Cuban Revolution. I don't know if you wanted to say more about that, because for me, that was incredible.
Well, she was in a way kind of in anticipating mm-hmm. The kind of line of liberation theology that would emerge in Latin America later.
Mm-hmm.
As Catholics after Vatican II in Latin America began to review what's the mission of the church, what's the mission of a Christian in a world of injustice and poverty and the violence of social oppression. Uh-huh. And she felt that the Cuban Revolution kind of came out of that vacuum in which Christians were identifying more with the status quo, with the rich, having schools for the rich and not for the poor. And that kind of cry of the poor had not been heard. She said, you know, in the Gospels, you know, Jesus says, you know, there are two people. God tells the master, whatever, tells them to do something. One of them says he won't do it, and then he does it. And the other, you know, says he will do it, but then he doesn't do it. Uh-huh. And she felt that there were Marxists and there were revolutionaries who were trying to respond to the needs of the poor and social justice, needs that the Christians had by and large overlooked. Now, she was not oblivious to limitations and problems with the revolution, and certainly issues of human rights that she was concerned about. But a lot of people were decrying this as anti-Christian. You know, Christians shouldn't have anything to do with the revolution. And yeah. She was urging that, you know, Christians should be outdoing the Marxists in their spirit of self-sacrifice and service to the common good. So I have to say that was very controversial, certainly back then. She was there just a month before the Cuban Missile Crisis, when the whole world almost blew up, or she didn't know that. Wow. And that was just the beginning of a decade of upheaval throughout the world that she was very much plugged into, especially then with the Vietnam War.
Wow, because in the book, it's like, we're on the side of the revolution. God bless the priests and the people of Cuba. God bless Castro and all those who are seeing Christ in the poor. I think it's such a prophetic message for us, you know, like 50 years later, and we're, you know, how do we see Christ in the poor? And, you know, we're dealing with this. You mentioned Congress. I think Congress needs to read your book and become familiar with Dorothy Day and this prophetic voice that she had, because she really had this deep commitment, the love for the poor and the love for the church. Mm-hmm. And then I know she traveled so many places. She was invited, I think, to Australia, and then that became like a whole world tour, because
yes.
She went to India and all over the place from there.
She went to Tanzania. She was met with Mother Teresa in India.
Yeah, so can you share some of her travels? Because I went to India when I was in seminary, and I went to, it wasn't even my plan to go to Calcutta, but third day there, I met the strange man who said, oh, if you're in India, I was near New Delhi. He said, you must come to Calcutta. I just met him, and he goes, you can stay at my house. I went like 20 something hours on a train to Calcutta all by myself. Oh, thinking back, if my daughter did this, because my daughter, I would say definitely no. But anyway, I went to this man's house. No Wi-Fi, no internet at the time, no cell phone. I go there. But then I said, if I go there, I have to see Mother Teresa. Of course, I didn't meet her, but I went to visit Missionaries of Charity. And it just, you know, I've written about it many times, but that was so touching for me. But anyway, she met with Mother Teresa, right?
They consider them, they were kind of two sisters. Mother Teresa came and visited her in New York. I was actually there. There's a famous picture of the two of them meeting together at Mary House.
And you were there?
I was there. I was not sitting.
Oh, please send a picture. Do you have a picture of that?
Yeah, I don't. It's not my picture, but there's a picture you can
look. Oh my goodness! Please send it to me.
So they really honored and respected one another. Mother Teresa gave her a pin of the Missionaries of Charity, sort of making her an honorary member of the missionaries. And it's interesting because they both respected each other, although they were very, very different, because, you know, they both began with that deep kind of mystical sense of that Christ is present in the face of the poor. You know, Mother Teresa's way was purely in the level of the works of mercy and charity, whereas Dorothy combined that with you know, social criticism, social activism to try to change the society. So there are significant differences there. And I think that Mother Teresa in some ways is more traditional. There are a lot of saints like that in history. There are very few like Dorothy Day that you can say who combine charity and justice in that way.
I can't think of any, and I'm not familiar with all of them, but yeah, so that's incredible. But you must find that picture, because I just find that would be so fascinating. I've always wanted to meet Mother Teresa, but anyway, just being in that Missionaries of Charity was just, it was kind of life-changing for me, because I just recognized the hard work that so many people do. And, you know, the rest of us, we just, you know, for me, it is a comfortable life just writing, but those who are really doing it, it is so hard work. Mm-hmm. So, you know, so in the 60s and then in the 70s, you talk about, you know, her arrests with farm workers.
That's right, yes.
The Vietnam War. So I don't know if you want to say a bit more about that.
Well, sure. That was, in fact, the last time she was arrested was with the farm workers in California in 1973.
Okay.
So she was, you know, 75 years old at the time. There's a famous picture of her by Robert Fitch that is kind of iconographic, which shows her sitting on this little folding stool that she liked to carry around the demonstrations. Uh-huh. And she's just sitting there very calm, Buddha-like, and sort of, you know, tranquility, with these great big heavy burly police officers with clubs and guns, you know, right in front of her. And it really is an amazing kind of icon of a spirit of peace, you know, and nonviolence in the midst of the situation. But so she was always a great fan of Cesar Chavez, because she, you know, had been from her roots in the 1930s when she started the Catholic Worker, very much, you know, supporting the cause of the workers. But she really felt that the farm workers, the United Farm Workers, was a social movement that was not just about better working conditions for the migrant workers, but had a kind of mystique to it, a kind of spirituality. Chavez and many of them were, you know, very devout Catholics themselves, and his kind of Gandhian spirit of nonviolence, you know, fasting as a weapon and using boycotts of enlisting people to boycott grapes and that sort of thing. And they experienced, you know, real violence that they encountered with the Teamsters Union and other people working for the growers who would attack them. So in Chavez was always going on fasts and using that as a you know, mechanism for trying to raise awareness and consciousness. So Dorothy, he was one of her heroes, and she would go out and visit him, you know, many times, and offered great support to the farm workers in New York and to operate out of the Catholic Worker as well. So that, you know, that was, it was significant to her that she went out there to march on a picket line. But a judge had issued an injunction against picketing, you know, in front of the fields, and so about 100 people or so were arrested. She was among them. My father actually happened to be in California at a peace convention, and he and Joan Baez and various people went down and visited her in jail. So the first time I met Dorothy Day, she said, "Well, I know you. Your father gave me a kiss when I was in jail." So we had that connection.
Wow, that is so incredible. And even at the age of 75, still protesting when many of us are just wanting to travel and relax and, you know, just enjoy our last years. That is incredible. Actually, in the 70s, in the introduction you wrote, in her old age, Dorothy began receiving recognition and honor, quite a departure from her usual marginal status, and not something she welcomed. Too much praise, she observed, makes you feel you must be doing something terribly wrong. Yeah. And I just found that so touching, because, you know, even as young people, we want praise all the time, you know, some trophy for something, some award. But she was so humble. And, you know, I read, you know, she declined all the honorary degrees.
Yes, yeah, she didn't. She felt she never graduated from college. She didn't feel she deserved an honorary degree. And she also objected to a lot of the schools, because they had ROTC training on school and received money from the Pentagon. So it was also a kind of a protest there. But it comes back, because there's still, you know, people who are worried about her being named as a saint. That's a way that we have of putting people on a pedestal, and we honor them, but we don't feel what they have to say is relevant to us or challenges our own lives in any way. And we can think, well, Mother Teresa could do that sort of thing. You know, she's a saint. I could, you know, you've been saying I could never do that. I could, you know, when I'm 75, I'm not going to get arrested or something. But you never know. There's still time to find out. But you know, she really believed that all Christians are called to holiness. There's a famous line that you've probably heard, and everybody seems to know this line, and I feel embarrassed because I had something to do with making it popular. Quoting her as saying, "Don't call me a saint. I don't want to be dismissed that easily." I included that in the introduction that I wrote for that her selected writings many decades ago. And since then, it's become the most famous thing she supposedly ever said. And people think that that means, oh, she didn't want to be a saint. Why are you talking about making her a saint? You know, well, she believed that all Christians were called to be saints, called to be holy. That didn't mean having been canonized or having a church named after you. But that was the whole point of being Christian, was to walk this path of holiness. Some people travel very far. Some people only a short distance. But that's what the whole thing was about. But when we call someone a saint, we mean that what their example is irrelevant to ordinary people like us. I could never do, you know, live with the poor or get arrested or that sort of thing. And so because we can't do that, we don't do anything, you know, and lets us off the hook. And so, you know, it's the same thing that, you know, that even in her lifetime, she kind of contended with that. She didn't, you know, want to be honored. She wanted people to take the gospel seriously. Mm-hmm. And if they thought that, well, these things came easily for her, which they'd be impossible for an ordinary person like me. Well, that also doesn't give her credit enough for how difficult it was for her, what sacrifice was involved from the very beginning of her vocation.
Wow.
How much perseverance, how much dedication and faith it required to just keep on going, because she didn't just live among the poor because it was so much fun, you know. It was part of a deep religious calling, and she remained faithful to that, even in the times when it was very, very difficult.
Yeah, we are all called to do that. It just, we find it so difficult, but she took it up and she was so faithful to that. And so May 1st is the 90th anniversary of the Catholic Worker. But, you know, all these years later, her work is still so relevant because she dealt with racial justice, you know, economic justice, and, you know, violence and war. So her work, that's why, you know, reading over these, her columns and her writings, you know, they still speak to us today. That's the prophetic voice, which is so challenging for us. Mm-hmm. I'm so grateful that you put it together. Any kind of words you want to share with us? Was it difficult to do this? Was it emotional because you have been with her and worked with her?
Well, it was actually a lot of fun for me, because these are sprawling, great, big, huge, long columns. And so it was a matter of boiling them down and abridging them. But I really enjoyed writing the commentary and the transitional notes and that sort of thing that I can bring to that, because I know the background of the story that she's writing about. So I was really curating this in a way that it would be readable to people who didn't live with her and didn't live through those times. But, you know, I knew Dorothy Day, you know, when she was quite old and when I was quite young, but I've spent a lifetime getting to know her better. Mm-hmm. And each of these projects that I've worked on has helped me to know her a little better. And it's important for me to, you know, to make it clear that all this activism, which is sort of on the surface, that's the visible part that we see, was really one side of a deep, you know, spirituality. And I understood that better from editing her diaries, The Duty of Delight. And I saw how much her life was rooted in this daily exercise of patience, of courage, of forgiveness, of restraining her impulse to judgment or criticism of people, because every day offered, you know, opportunities. So, you know, the Saint Benedict, founder of monasticism, you know, called the monastery a school of charity. He felt that the way of holiness was in community and not just living by yourself as a desert, you know, monk or something like that. And she brought that very much, you know, into her life in the Catholic Worker as well. And her favorite saint was a Carmelite mystic named Thérèse of Lisieux, who died when she was very young in France in 1897, who left a book about her spirituality, which she called The Little Way, which was that the path to holiness is not just in great big heroic things or standing in, you know, in before the lions in the, you know, in the arena or something, but in the everyday opportunities to be more forgiving, more loving with the people that we encounter all around us, because that means that everybody we encounter offers us opportunities to exercise those virtues. So it was that exercise of charity and love in very small everyday kind of ways that then prepared her, was the arena in which she trained to be able to deal, you know, without flinching by being arrested or picket lines or being shot at it. She was in the South. I think that's something very important to take away from her as well.
Yeah. Are you working on any more of her, any more books on her or editing?
I am actually halfway through editing a book that kind of focuses on her spirituality.
Wow. When will that be coming out? This year or next?
Not this year. Maybe next year. Maybe next year.
Wow. You are incredible, Robert. I am like, you just blow me away. All the work that you've done as a publisher at Orbis and then working with Dorothy Day and writing and editing 25 books. You are a miracle worker. That's all I can say. So thank you so much for your time on Madame Podcast. I hope everyone, because I think you may have been my first Catholic guest. I think more people need to read about Dorothy Day. They can get this on pilgrimage 70s and 60s from Orbis Books. That's right. And it's such a joy to talk with you. And I think I can talk with you all day long, but I know you're very, very busy. So thank you so much for sharing your two books. And hope to have you back again on Madame Podcast.
I would love that. Thank you very much, Grace. Real pleasure.
Please join Homebrew Christianity's online class, Bonhoeffer and the Future of Faith. This class will explore the work of Dietrich Bonhoeffer and examine how his ideas remain relevant to the challenges we face today. It is hosted by Drs. Trip Fuller and Jeff Pugh. The class is free, but donations help support the continued amazing work of Homebrewed Christianity. Please visit www.tripfuller.com to sign up today. Orbis Books is offering 30% off three books by Robert Ellsberg, who is a publisher at Orbis Books: A Living Gospel, Reading God's Story in Holy Lives, and On Pilgrimage, the 60s, and On Pilgrimage, the 70s. These three great books provide a deeper understanding of Dorothy Day and also the lives of saints, prophets, and spiritual masters. Order these three books today at orbisbooks.com and use discount code MAD, M-A-D, to get 30% off.
For sponsorship inquiries, please email madangpodcast@gmail.com.